I think that's it. I can't think of anything else. So Joshua chapter 6 is where we left off. And we are firing our way through the book of Joshua. This has been a good book for me personally. I don't know about you, but I've been getting a lot out of it. It slays me most every time I read it. But other than that, it's been pretty good. Once you stem the bleeding, it's really not bad. We finished chapter 5. We'll back up a couple verses just to remember where we are. The Israelites are crossing over Jordan. They have crossed over there into the promised land. And behind them is the Jordan River, which miraculously parted. Ahead of them is the city of Jericho, walled city, very strong. And they are between those two spots, facing an obstacle that they can't do on their own, and back to one that they couldn't do on their own and were led across. And if you remember, they were preparing for battle. And at the end of last chapter, in chapter 5, verse 13, it says this: "And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, Art thou for us or for our adversaries?" He threw up the halt. Who goes there? You know, cross that. "You for us or our adversaries?" And he said, "Nay, not. But as the captain of the host of the Lord am I now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, "What saith my Lord unto his servant?" And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, "Loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy." And Joshua did so. And so we had this man show up on the scene. And it was the same man that was the voice in the burning bush. It was, I believe very strongly, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ before he came as Jesus. He shows up as the captain of the Lord's army here. And there's a good indication that's the case because of what Joshua does. Joshua face plants and worships. And anytime it's an angel, and there are instances where angels show up on the scene, whenever an angel shows up on the scene and somebody tries to worship him, like John did in Revelation, the angel says, "Cut that out. Get up. You worship God, not me. I'm just an angel. I mean, I'm higher than you, but I have nothing to worship. God, worship God only." And say it just like that, but that's the implication. "I'm just a fellow servant," is what they say. And so this person, whoever he is, allows himself to be worshipped. And he says the same thing that the voice from the burning bush that told Moses his name was, which is, "Loose your shoes off your feet if you're standing on holy ground." And so Joshua does that. And interesting, he asked, "Are you for us or are you against us?" And we spent some time talking about that last time. And the answer was, "No, I'm not for you or against you. The question is, are you for me? Because I'm here to do what the Lord has sent me to do. And the question is, are you on my side or are you not?" And Joshua immediately got that. You can tell by the position of his face at this man's feet. And so here we are. And chapter 6, verse 1 starts like this: "Now Jericho was straitly shut up because of the children of Israel, none went out and none came in." It is closed up. And Jericho, where they were, could see Jordan, could see the children of Israel when they were on the other side, 2 to 3 million people, and saw them with a river, which we were told it's after the harvest time, it's at flood stage, so it's at least the Jordan at that time, no dams on it back then, roughly, you know, half a mile or more wide. And they could see them and figured, well, we've got some time, because to pony 2 to 3 million people across a river takes a while. But then in one afternoon, the Lord divides the water, and it said it heaped up, and across they came. So now Jericho is in the position of being sieged. And it is shut up. They don't let anybody in or let anybody out. Normally, what would happen when you fought a battle against a walled city is, you know, a couple things. I mean, you could try to attack it directly, pull down the walls, bash down the gates. Archaeologically, Jericho was a tough place. It was kind of, most cities were built on a mound, and this is actually, Jericho, and I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, has a couple distinctions. It is the oldest known city in the world, and it is also the lowest point, the lowest city anywhere below sea level, 900 and something feet, I think, below sea level. But Nonetheless, it was built on a mound. That's how they would build a city on higher ground. And at the very bottom of this mound, you had a retaining wall. And from digs, we find out that first retaining wall was about 15 feet high. So in order to get in there, and then built on top of the retaining wall that would keep the bottom part of the dirt in, was the first wall, which was about 6 feet thick and was about 25 feet high. So the Israelites, in order to get past the first wall, would have to go over about 40 feet of wall. It's really tough to go over 40 feet of wall with people up above shooting arrows at you, throwing rocks on you, dumping boiling oil, boiling water on you. It really is no fun. And so it's not a simple thing. And then after that, actually, we know that there were dual walls in Jericho. You had the outer walls that I just described. Then you had a space of ground in between, which still rose up gradually. And then you had another 6 foot thick, 25 foot high wall, the second wall of Jericho. So if you happen to somehow get over the first one and through it, you'd go through the same thing again. As you tried to approach the walls, the people inside would just wail on you. Now, so normally, one of the ways that you would attack a city like that, other than trying to bash down the walls, and it was mud brick walls, so fire isn't going to do you a whole lot of good, is they just starve people out. They just camp the army around the outside so nobody can go in and nobody can go out, and just wait. Wait and wait and wait. If anybody tries to get out, you kill them, and you just wait there. And we've seen that used in various ways. When Jerusalem was taken by Titus Vespasian in 70 AD, it's about 6 months that they enclosed the city and didn't let anybody come in or come out. And, you know, some of the sieges we have on record, when you go through, I think it's Kings or Chronicles, it was at the point where people were so hungry that they were eating, you know, they give the price for how much for a cab of dove's dung and how much for a donkey's head. And there's records of people cooking their own children and eating them. It's really bad. But the benefit is of having a city like that, it's real tough to take it, and a small amount of people can defend against a big group. You know, one of the famous sieges in our country's history is the Battle of the Alamo. You guys are familiar with that. And when that happened, there were somewhere between 200 to 250 people inside the Alamo, and they had about 6,000 on the outside of the Alamo. And they held them off for 13 days and killed over 1,000 people before they finally lost. And, you know, with the higher ground, with the city, especially one that can't be burnt, and before the advent of bullets, which can shoot you from a distance, you really have a tremendous advantage. And Jericho was a city that was not easily taken. Not only that, we know that from archaeology, inside of Jericho there were springs, so they weren't going to die of thirst real quick. And in Joshua in chapter 3, it told us that it was just after the time of harvest, so they had a full load of crops. So this was not going to be a quick thing for them to be able to starve them out, and it was not going to be an easy thing. And so Joshua was just kind of sitting there, looking it over, and this guy shows up and is going to give him directions. Now, you know, the Lord did this for a reason. There are other cities we're going to see in a little bit. They fight the city Ai, which is smaller. And I don't think it's even walled, but God took them specifically to the hardest one first, because he takes you and I to the hardest one first. And I think the reason why is he wants to take us to a place where immediately we come to the realization that we're powerless on our own. If normally, you know, it's like the basketball, the athletic directors around here, when they set up their schedule, they try to start their season with a couple weak teams, because you want to build your team's confidence up in their abilities, and you want to try to get a couple of the, you know, the schools that have 10 or 12 students total in them, so that you can just destroy them and your guys feel really good about themselves and you've got some time to work into the fight. And that's what you would think they would do, because the Israelites, they've had a few battles. They did fight the giants and whatnot, but, you know, you want to kind of work into this thing. God doesn't work that way. He says, because if I did that, you know, you'd get this stupid idea that you could actually do it on your own. So how about we find one that you can't possibly win? Let's take you someplace where you got no choice. And that's where Joshua is. He's sitting there looking at the city, and this man shows up. And it says in verse 2, the Lord said unto Joshua, see, I have given into thy hand Jericho and the king thereof, and the mighty men of valor. Oh, great. You mean besides the two walls, there's mighty men of valor. Oh, that's nice to know, that once I get through the walls, then I got a bunch of bad dudes to fight. I mean, it just gets worse and worse on one hand, but then here's the Lord telling him, I have given. I have already done it. You know, it's done. And from God's perspective, he sees the end from the beginning. It's already a done deal. So, and so he gives them the battle plan. And Joshua's got to be thinking, this is it. I'm waiting for it. Here's my battle plan. I finally get to go into battle. Okay, what's the strategy? Are we going to battering ram? Are we going to be going for the ladders and the hooks? Are we, you know, we're going to dig a tunnel? What are we doing? How do we get into this place? And here's the battle plan from the Lord. And you shall compass the city, all you and the men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shalt thou do for 6 days. Yeah, psychological warfare, that's it. We'll march around, you know, we'll do our victory. You know, we'll just kind of walk around and look them down and get them real scared. All right, I'm liking that, you know. And that's an old tradition. I was reading a thing about this wrestler. His name was Milo of Croton, about 540 B.C., and he was in some of the early Olympics. He won the wrestling match in like five in a row, which was unheard of. And he used to psych out his opponents by, same way people try to do it today, you know, to look tough, he'd do feats of strength. He would take, one of the things he did that I thought was cool or made me remember him was he would take a cord and he would tie it real tight around his forehead. And then he'd hold his breath until his veins popped out enough to snap the little cord around his head. You know, just something to show people how tough he was. He used to stand on like a greased disc and have people try to push him off. He'd take a pomegranate and he'd put it in his hand and he'd hold it. And he'd have people try to pry it out of his hand. And they couldn't bend his fingers open to get it out, but he wouldn't crush the thing either. He was just like a rock. And he had all these cool things he did to psych people out. So Joshua hears that, verse 3, okay. Yeah, a little psychological warfare. We'll walk around, show them how tough we are. Sounds good. Until verse 4, it says, and 7 priests shall bear before the ark. That's cool. The ark is going with us. That's where that was the visible representation of God. That is God going before us. 7 shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. On the 7th day, you shall compass the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow with the trumpets. That's all right. Some warm-up music. I'm good with that. All right. Warm-up music. We're psyching them out. We can do this. And it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat, and the people shall ascend up every man straight before him. Okay, let me get this straight. We're going to walk around this thing for 6 days, once a day. On the 7th day, we're going to go around it 7 times, and then we're going to blow in a horn, and everybody's going to shout, and the walls are going to drop. Yep, that's it. Good plan. Go tell your generals. Okay, all right, guys, huddle up. Here's the plan. I mean, think about trying to sell this. And I don't even know from reading this whether he told them the whole plan up front or he said, this is what the Lord told me to do. We're just going to go out, walk around at once, shut your mouth, and then go back to the camp. I'll give you further direction from there. Personally, I would probably go with that way because the whole plan, you got to, you know, it just doesn't seem to make any sense at first pass. Although we did talk about this a little bit last time, and remember where they were going. They would leave. They were in Gilgal, where they had crossed the river. They'd set up a memorial of stones from the water that had been parted by God to remind them that God had parted the water and brought them through a thing that they couldn't do. And so they would leave the place of remembrance, and they'd walk one time all the way around that city. And they'd see all the walls. And they'd see everybody up above looking down on them. Of course, they would presumably be far enough out so they wouldn't get shot or rocked or, you know, oiled or whatever you'd do from up above. And they'd see these walls that they couldn't, that were 40 feet over their head, and realize, nope, no weakness. Been around the whole thing. Not a shot. Okay, back we go. And then, oh yeah, there's that pile of rocks again. And he takes them back to the place of remembrance. Next day, same second verse, same as the first. Around the building, checking it out, looking for holes. Nothing. How are we going to do this? I don't have any idea. And the last time they go around it 7 times, just to be sure that nothing's changed, that there's no chance for them to get in. And it gives you an understanding of why Joshua was told at the beginning, I want you to be strong and of a good courage. Oh yeah, and you, be strong and of a good courage. And oh, by the way, in chapter 1, like 5 times, be strong and of a good courage, because he's called to do things that maybe don't make any sense. Certainly doesn't seem possible in his eyes. But the reason why he's Joshua and he's leading the people and he's the first guy to get his own book named after him is because of verse 6. Immediately after he hears that, it says, and Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said unto them, take up the ark of the covenant, let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And he said unto the people, pass on and compass the city, and let him that is armed pass on before the ark of the Lord. And he's immediately obedient. which, I don't know, I kind of like to know. I don't know about you. I like to know the plan. I look for the plan ahead of time laid out, the 3 points, the long-range plan, the 1 year, the 3 year, the 5 year plan. And yet he doesn't get that. He just gives them the get ready, we're going around. And, you know, the truth is, do we really need to know? Do you really need to know all the details? Probably just freak out if you really knew anyways. It would probably, if you actually knew what the Lord was going to do, you know, you can look back at your life and maybe see where you are now. I know it is true for me. I can look at where I am right now and say, if you had told me 10 years ago this is what I was going to be doing, I'd probably just run like a little girl, you know. And yet, little by little, as you need to know, and certainly we're told over and over again to trust in the Lord with all our heart. Lean not in our own understanding, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. And all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. And, you know, lean not on your own understanding. Because your own understanding is very limited. You know, one of the comforting verses for me when I don't know what in the world is going on is Philippians 4, 6, which says, be careful for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. There's a peace that comes from God that passes understanding. And I said before, there is a peace that comes with understanding. When you have to pay bills and you know exactly how much money is in your account and you've laid it all out and you know how much you got coming in and going up, there is a peace that comes from that. Presuming there's more in your account than there is that has to go to the bills. But when you cross that line to all of a sudden the red side is way bigger than the black side, at that point, you need the peace that passes understanding, because understanding shows me way short on what I'm going to need. But yet he says, if we're careful in everything and we pray and we ask him and we give him thanks for what he's done, he'll give us peace that passes understanding, and he'll keep our hearts and our minds through Christ Jesus. Because that's really where the battle is, let's be honest. Your heart, you get scared. Your heart, you freak out. Your heart, you don't want to trust. And then your mind, you start thinking. And you start thinking about, you ever get that? That, you know, you start doing the labor breath when you start thinking, I'm not going to have enough to do this. I don't, and, you know, and sometimes you just got to, you got to do that. You got to just say, you know what, I can't even be careful about this. And I think they were in the heavy breathing stage. First time around that whole place, seeing those mean people up there yelling at them, seeing those thick walls, and they were going, you know. I mean, they beat some giants, yes, through the Lord's help, but there's a difference between a, you know, 7 or 8 foot giant and a 40 foot wall. There's a very big difference between those two things. And so he said, pass on, encompass the city, and let him that is armed pass on. He didn't say, and it's interesting to note, because I don't know where all of you have been through your Christian experience. He didn't say, deny the existence of the walls. He didn't say, walk around it and say, there's no wall, no wall, I see no wall. He didn't say, you know, he didn't tell him to walk around and yell at the walls and say, you've fallen, you've already fallen, you're not there, you know, and yet there are some sides of Christianity, and there are certainly other, you know, Christian Science, which somebody said I thought very accurately is neither Christian nor science, has you, you know, if you acknowledge the problem, it's a lack of faith. So you just have to pretend it's not there, you know. And if you're there missing a hand, spurting blood, saying, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, you're going to, I mean, that's foolishness. He doesn't tell them there's no wall. He wants them to know very well and be very familiar with the wall, because he wants them to understand that he's stronger than the wall. And so that's the whole point of going around. I'm convinced of it, to go around and see, yep, you don't have it in you. And then he calls for the armed men. He says, the armed men went before the priests and blew with the trumpets, and the rearward came after the ark, the priests going on and blowing with the trumpets. You know, for us, are you armed? Are you an armed man? Are you an armed woman? Not physically, unless you're guarding the door, in which case that's okay if you're armed. But, you know, we're told in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations. That's the kind of weapon I need, because my imagination is nasty. When I start imagining all the bad stuff that's going to happen, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Sometimes it's like herding cats. I don't know about you. If you're just one of those people who sits and thinks, like I can tell with my wife, if she's okay, we'll just talk. You know, when we come home at night and she's been there all day with four little kids, and so she craves adult conversation, and I understand that, and so I've been there with adults, and I crave silence, but, you know, I go into her world and die there. That's what I'm called to do, and you know, we can talk about stuff, and a lot of times we have some really good conversations, especially after the kids finally get in bed, and it's just, you know, you talk. Well, the way she works and the way I work are completely different, because for me, at night, when, okay, good night, I mean, I'm gone. That's just it. At night, my mind shuts off. Once she gets going, that head starts going, and it just doesn't shut off. You know, it's like one of those cars where you turn off the key and it keeps going. You know, it just doesn't want to stop. And for her, that's her time when those thoughts can start going. For me, it's more in the morning, because I get up first thing in the morning and I start thinking about the things that I have to do. And, well, I don't get up first in the morning, but I get up partway through the morning and I start thinking about everything I have to do, and you just get overwhelmed with it. But for both of us, it's like trying to keep cats in the yard or something. You know, they're just like thoughts going everywhere, and yet we're told that the weapons of our warfare are able to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. I need that, because my thoughts, man, they're just horrible sometimes, trying to get everything in. And we need to be armed. I mean, we're given prayer, we're given the word, we're given, those are our weapons. And if we're not proficient in those, we're defenseless, we're useless on the battlefield. For us as believers, it's the word, it's prayer, it's fellowship, it's the breaking of bread. Those are the things that we're given and we should be doing. You know, you guys are familiar with Ephesians 6 and the armor that you have, your shield of faith and your helmet of salvation, your breastplate of righteousness, your belt of truth, the feet shod with the preparation of the gospel. I mean, those are the things that we have, and that's what we need to be in so that we're ready to go. Now, this kills me. Here you've got the armed men went before the priests in verse 9. Verse 10, and Joshua had commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor make any noise with your voice. Neither shall any word proceed out of your mouth until the day I bid you to shout. Then you shall shout. So Joshua tells the people, we're going to go, we're going to fight. This is the battle plan. Now shut up and just walk around. I don't want to hear nothing. I don't want you whistling. I don't want you humming. I don't want you talking. I don't want you. I mean, and think about how hard that is, because most places, even if it's just the armed men, 2 to 3 million Israelites coming out of there, we know from the numbers, probably 600,000 or so fighting men. How do you keep 600,000 men quiet from talking? Most churches can't even keep 20 people from shredding each other, let alone, you know, 600,000 quiet as they walk around this whole building not saying a word. And I think there's great wisdom in that. I know for me, my mouth is the worst thing. It shouldn't be that hard. I mean, James talks all about the tongue and how nasty it is, and one of the sayings I like the best is, you've got a tongue and it comes with its own cage. But yet, so hard to just close the door. There's some great Proverbs that talk about running your lips. Proverbs 29:11, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keeps it in until afterwards. A fool just pours it out, got to say it. You got to know how I feel. Proverbs 18:6, a fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calleth for strokes. One of the translations says, a fool's mouth invites a beating. And I don't know you, I don't know how many beatings I brought on myself, because it says a fool's lips enters into contention. And, you know, my propensity is to think I know more than I do, pick a fight where I shouldn't be fighting, and to stand on something I shouldn't stand on, and take out my sword and hack off somebody's ears, and to pick a fight. And, you know, I can be right. You can be right, and you can be dead right, you know, where you're so right that you're killing somebody with how right you are. And it's really not, Jesus didn't say, you know, go you therefore into all the world and slay them with your arguments. He doesn't say that. He says, make converts. We're winning people. We're not supposed to be destroying people. And sometimes, look, we're a church that I think rightfully is focused on the word. That's what we do. But this, you can get prideful with that. I can get prideful with that, where you think, well, we're the only ones doing it right, and we're the only ones who know, and you guys are just losing it because you do that, and that's stupid, ha, you know. And you, and when you say stupid, ha, you're going into people's hearts, and it's foolishness to get into contention over stupid things. Instead, you know, we should be winning people. And I'm talking to me, because like I said, this slays me when I read this book. Proverbs 17:27, he that has knowledge spareth his words, and a man of understanding is of an excellent spirit. In fact, even a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise, and he that shuts his lips is esteemed a man of understanding. In other words, if you just shut your mouth, people will think you're smart, you know, until you start talking. That's when it goes downhill. It is for me. Proverbs 10:19, in the multitude of words there wanteth not sin, but he that refraineth his lips is wise. And isn't that true? The more talking that's going on, somebody's sinning. Because they're slandering somebody, they're saying something stupid, they're cutting somebody up, and yet, nope. Shut your mouth. Shut my mouth. For me, I would think even more than the saying stupid things or taunting the enemy right here, their problem would be complaining because of the plan that they're called to do. But yet, Philippians 2:14 says, do all things without murmurings and disputings, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. If there was ever a group of people who live in the midst of a crooked and perverse, the word crooked in that is scolios, like bent. Our world is bent, and it's in perverse, it's twisted, it's warped. And yet he says, if you do everything without complaining, fighting amongst yourselves, you'll shine as a light. And you don't hear a light. Notice that? Light doesn't say anything. It's just bright. People see it. So, you know, there's something different about that. We're called to be salt and light. You don't hear salt. You taste it. But you don't hear it. So he tells them, I want you to walk around this place, and I don't want you to say nothing. Verse 11, so the ark of the Lord compassed the city, going about it once. Again, who's fighting? The Lord is. That's the whole point of this, by the way, is it's the Lord's battle. And they came into the camp and lodged in the camp, back by the pile of stones. And Joshua rose early in the morning, putting me to shame once again, getting up early. He just does this over and over. Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. And seven priests, bearing seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord, went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armed men went before them. The rearward came after the ark of the Lord, the priests going on and blowing with the trumpets. And the second day they compassed the city once and returned into the camp. So they did 6 days. And it is, I think, important for us to continually remember where we've been, what he's done. Go back to where you were, where you remember. You know, we're told to remember the rock from which we're hewn and the pit from which we've been digged. And it's important. It doesn't mean we have to live there and dwell or celebrate the past, but it's important to remember what he's got us through. And it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early, about the dawning of the day, and compassed the city after the same manner seven times. Only on that day they compassed the city seven times. And it came to pass at the seventh time, when the priests blew with the trumpets, Joshua said unto the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city shall be a curse, even it and all that are therein, to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And ye, in any wise, keep yourselves from the accursed thing, lest you make yourselves accursed. When you take the accursed thing and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of brass and iron are consecrated unto the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. You know, this is the first fruits, the first place they're going to take in the land, and the Lord is going to completely do the fight. And because of that, because the battle is his and he does all of the work, the first fruits are consecrated to him. And he says, I don't want you to take any of it. Just, we're going to destroy everything except for the gold and the silver and that. That's going into the Lord's house. None of this is yours because you're not doing it. God's doing it. And, you know, for them to keep it for themselves, the things that belong to him, would make them accursed, he said, and trouble the camp of Israel. And, you know, we can do the same thing. I mean, you know me, I hate to talk about money at all. I really don't even like to do it. We don't collect an offering or anything. There's a box in the back. If the Lord lays on your heart to give, give. And he's done that and he's provided for us. But I know personally, the Lord still speaks about giving in a bunch of different ways. He speaks about giving, you know, in the Old Testament, it was the tithe, it was the tenth. In the New Testament, it's every man as he purposes in his heart, every man as he's able. And however you can do it joyfully, because God wants a joyful giver. And so if you're scowling about dropping $5, keep it, have a pizza, because he doesn't want it, he doesn't need it. He's not broke, he's not on welfare, you know, the ministry is not going to die. Folks, come on, folks, gotta give or it's going to die, we're going to go under. That's a horrible witness. You know what, let it go under then. If it's relying upon me and my giving, it had better go under. Let something else start that's of the Lord, you know. But yet, on the other hand, the flip side, God does call for us to give. And to take something that he claims is his own is really robbing him. He says this in Malachi 3:8. He says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even the whole nation. Bring you all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in my house. And prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground. Neither shall your vine cast a fruit before the time in the field, saith the Lord of hosts. All the nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, saith the Lord of hosts." And the idea is, God, you give him what he asked for, and he will take care of you. Now, Jesus, you know, they came to him, you remember, in the New Testament, and they said, "Should we pay taxes or not?" And he said, "Give me a coin." And so they fish out a coin, and he said, whose image is on that anyways? And they said, "Well, it's Caesar's image." And he said, "Well, you give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and you give to God what belongs to God." And the implication was the money had Caesar's face stamped on it, the imprint of Caesar. It was made in Caesar's image. So the stuff that belongs to him, give to him. And he said, the stuff that belongs to God, give to God. Well, what has God's imprint on it? It says, in the beginning, he created us male and female. Let's create man after our image. Because God's really a whole lot more interested in you than he is your stuff. And he's more interested in you than he is what you can do for him. And I think really the call throughout the book of Joshua is a call to giving him yourself completely, to obedience, to surrender, to allowing him to have his way in your life. And our tendency is always to hold back part, to say, well, you can have this part of my life. I'll give you an hour on Sunday, and that'll be your time, but this is my time, and I want this. It's mine. My precious. You know, I mean, you get to kind of get Gollum-y with yourself, and you think, but yet, the Lord wants your heart, and he wants us to give him ourselves completely. So in verse 20, it says, "So the people shouted." And it's interesting. Two verses describe the whole battle. I mean, the first six chapters is all about the battle, going into the battle of Jericho, getting across, going to the battle of Jericho. The battle is two verses. "So the people shouted when the priest blew the trumpets. And it came to pass, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. They wiped it out." Now, there are some people who would look at that and say, God is mean. He wiped out the kids. He killed everybody. You find it funny? What's one story that you always get in Sunday school? Even no matter where you went to, if you went to church somewhere, you went to Sunday school, you always get Joshua in the battle of Jericho. Joshua in the battle of Jericho, Jericho, and the walls came down. I mean, we teach him that one. We teach him, what, you know, David and Goliath. You ever think about the stories that we think are kids' stories? They kill everybody in the city. They wipe them out completely. David and Goliath, he cuts off his head with a sword and runs around with his head showing everybody Goliath's head. I mean, these are the children's stories that we have in the Bibles. But, you know, it really wasn't Joshua in the battle of Jericho. It was God in the battle of Jericho. Joshua was just along for the ride. So you ask yourself, well, why is this? Well, you have to understand, this isn't arbitrary. God just didn't say, kill all of them. Just let them go. I'm done with them. I mean, this, he first spoke of this 450 years ago to Abraham. And he said, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. But they continued to get worse and worse and worse for 450 years to the point they'd hit the point of no return. And sometimes, you know, there are people who would say, I can't imagine how God of love would do that. Well, do you really think that you care more about the people of Jericho than God does? Do you really think that? Do you really think that you really have a bigger heart? You don't understand the Lord. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 39, the Israelites were supposed to win the land the first time, and they didn't. And they said, it's too much for us. There are walled cities, like the one that just fell down. And there are giants, like they already beat. And our children will become prey, is what they said. It'll wipe out our kids, so we can't go into the land when they rebelled. And so the Lord said, okay, you won't go in, you're not going in. You won't go in. You're going to wander around here till every one of you guys die. But he said this in verse 39. He says, moreover, your little ones, which you said should be a prey, and your children, which in that day had no knowledge between good and evil, they shall go in thither, and unto them will I give it, and they shall possess it. And the Lord spared the kids because they didn't know any better. You look at Jonah, and Jonah wants Nineveh destroyed because he hates them. And he's mad at God. He doesn't want to go there in the first place. God says, go to Nineveh. And it's not because he's scared. It's because he hates him and he wants him to die. And finally, when he does go, because the Lord, you know, does the whole fish thing, and he gets barfed up on the shore, and he goes to Nineveh, and he preaches that compassionate message of 40 days and Nineveh's no more. I'm out of here. And he stands outside on a hill and waits for fire. Waits for fire. Waits for fire. And God teaches him a lesson. He, in the sun, he lets this little gourd grow up over his head to give him shade. And then a worm comes and eats the gourd, and the gourd dies, so there's no shade. And Jonah starts cursing it, the gourd, you know. And God says, you care more about that stupid plant than all those people down there in that city. What's wrong with you? And he says in Jonah 4:11, he says, should not I spare Nineveh, that great city, wherein there are more than 60,000 persons, that's 60, that's 120,000 persons, that cannot discern between their right hand and their left? Lord knows. Lord has mercy. And Nineveh was horrible. They had horribly abused his people. They were servants of the Dagon, the fish god. They put fish hooks in their mouths. They were nasty, and yet the Lord still had mercy because the kids didn't know any better. But at this point, they were beyond the point of no return. And we know from history that the Canaanites were horribly vile people, including idolatry to the point where they were sacrificing their children to their gods. They were practicing gross sexual immorality, including pedophilia and everything else. And God said, no, that's enough. Time's up. Does that mean that some of the young kids that were killed, you know, were eternally separated from God? I doubt it, because he's shown us very well that he loves little kids. But yet, he also knew that even the youngest ones that had been indoctrinated in that would spread, and it would be like leaven going through his people, and so it had to be wiped out. He didn't want a trace of it left. So he had them wipe them all out. But Joshua said unto the two men that had spied out the country, go into the harlot's house, and bring out thence the woman, and all that she hath, as you swear unto her. And the young men that were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brethren and all that she had, and they brought her all her kindred and left them without the camp of Israel. Because obviously the Lord knew how to preserve those that are his. I mean, she had faith. She said, I know that you guys serve the only living God. And all she'd heard was the same stories of people coming through the gate that everyone else had heard. And the Lord recognized her faith and he protected her through it. And interestingly enough, I was having a discussion with Aaron from the pastor down in Bangor, assistant pastor, and you know, there have been three, I think, archaeological digs, and one of the things they found is that on the north side, there's a portion of the wall that didn't drop. The rest of it just crumbled. It wasn't that they necessarily fell out flat. They just dropped down. But yet, there is a section on the north side, and they know from archaeology that some of those that section had houses built against it. Didn't fall for some reason. Probably because there was a red cord tied to the window, and there was a harlot and her family in the house. And the Lord brought them out. And they burnt the city with fire, and all that was therein. Only the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and of iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. Completely consumed. And again, I historically, in the archaeological digs, when they get down there to that level, I think it's around 1400 BC or so, when they find that part of the city, they find the burnt stuff, and it included like all the grain, everything was burnt up, and they have that there, meaning that they didn't even take any of the food, like they were told not to. They left it and they burn it all because the Lord said, don't touch it. And Joshua saved Rahab the harlot alive and her father's household and all that she had. And she dwelled in Israel even unto this day, because she hid the messengers which Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And Joshua adjured them at that time, saying, cursed be the man before the Lord that rises up and buildeth this city Jericho. He shall lay the foundation thereon, and his firstborn and his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it. And that was fulfilled, actually, if you go to 1 Kings 16:34, when that was rebuilt in Ahab's day. It tells us the name of the guy who rebuilt that city. And just like he said, it gives the names of his kids that died in doing it, because he said he would be cursed. And it says, so the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was noised throughout all the country. Not by Joshua's mouth. He let other people speak for him. In fact, I don't think anybody had to speak. It was a matter of the power of the Lord working through him that everybody heard his name and knew what he did. I just want to read a couple verses in the next chapter. This is one of the scariest chapters in Joshua to me. It says, but the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed thing, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against the children of Israel. They were told not to touch anything, and yet this one guy, Achan, took something he wasn't supposed to take. We'll find out later on that he took some gold and some silver, and he took a garment, hid it under the floor of his tent. And a couple interesting things, first of all, is that God knew who he was. Specifically, he was Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi. He knew exactly who he was. It says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the children of Israel, the whole group. And they didn't know it. They thought, they just came off of this great battle, and they thought everything was hunky-dory. And they didn't know what Achan did. They didn't know there was sin in the camp. Unfortunately, it says in verse 2, and Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth-Aven, on the east side of Bethel, and spake unto them, saying, go up and view the country. And the men went up and viewed Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said unto him, let not all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and smite Ai, and make not all the people to labor thither, for they are but few. So there went up thither of the people about 3,000 men, and they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai smote them about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate even to Shebarim, and smote them in the going down, wherefore the hearts of the people melted and became as water. You'll notice the last battle, the really scary one, where was Joshua at the beginning of that? He was on his face in front of the Lord, asking, what do you want me to do? Now they come to an easy one, and there's no mention of Joshua seeking the Lord at all. He just says, yeah, let's just go check out Ai. Oh, yeah, we'll send a few. You guys just go do that. It's a little one. I got this one, Lord. Don't you worry about it. You take care of the walled ones. I'll take the small ones. God, I can manage this one on my own. In verse 5, it says 36 people died. Those are the only recorded casualties in the book of Joshua in taking all the land of Canaan. It's the only ones they list, 36 people that died, because they didn't check with the Lord, and they went out in their own strength, and didn't realize there was sin in the camp. And it says the heart of the people melted and became as water. Everybody freaked out when they lost. We lost to little Ai, just Ai. You know, you got walls, they're just, hey, they're, it's like we just took Portland, and now we lost to Kossuth, or we lost to Prentice. We, you know, Chesta kicked our hinies. I mean, it just doesn't make, it's like it's unfathomable. And now Joshua, it says, he rent his clothes and he fell to the earth upon his face before the ark of the Lord, even until the eventide, he and the elders of Israel, and put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, alas, O Lord God, wherefore hast thou at all brought this people over Jordan to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites, to destroy us? Would to God we had been content and dwelt on the other side of Jordan. Sounds like he's been listening to those people that were out in the wilderness saying, it'd be better for us to die. At least in Egypt they had garlic and they had vegetables and spices. You just want to kill us. We know what it is. And he's already singing that song. 36 people die. Now, again, 36 people out of, 600,000 soldiers is not dramatic loss, but yet they lost to a little city that they should have been able to overwhelm with 2,000 or 3,000 people. And here he is saying, Lord, it'd been better. What's going on? Oh, Lord, what shall I say when Israel turneth their backs before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land shall hear of it and shall environ us round and cut off our name from the earth. And what wilt thou do unto thy great name? In other words, Lord, people are going to start talking. And when they find out that just little AI can beat us, they're all going to swarm us and wipe us out. I love this verse 10. And the Lord said unto Joshua, get thee up. Wherefore liest thou upon thy face? What are you doing on your face? He says, Israel sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them. For they have even taken the accursed thing, and have also stolen and dissembled also, and they put it even among their own stuff. Here he is, down on his face, saying, Lord, why aren't things working out for me? Lord, why am I having these problems? Lord, why are we getting defeated? And, he should have been praying at the beginning, before he went into battle. But now, after the battle, when he's defeated, he's praying, and God basically says, what are you doing on your face? To sin in the camp. You really expect me to fight for you when you're not in obedience to what I said to do? I told you, don't touch anything. Somebody touch something. And how many times are we, come up against it, and the Lord is, drilling us because there's an area in our life that is not right, and it's secret, and it's hidden, and yet we're like, Lord, I'm a Christian, you've forsaken me. And he's saying, well, then why aren't you listening to me? Why are you wondering why you're being defeated when you're harboring sin and you haven't dealt with it? How about you go take care of that? And, it's interesting to know. Joshua didn't know. He didn't know. Maybe he should have been in a position to know. I bet if he would have prayed before he went to fight, he would have known. The Lord would have shown him. But he was, being confident in himself. Achan's sin, I'm sure Achan had the same conversation in his head that we all have. Nobody will know. I can get away with this and nobody will know. I'm the only guy in the tent. It's not that much stuff. Put it right in here. Who's going to miss it? It's clothes. God doesn't even want the clothes. That's just going to burn. A little gold, a little silver. What's the big deal? Nobody's going to know. Not only that, it's not going to hurt anybody else. They're not hurting anybody. Well, there's 36 people that would beg to differ. And everybody else's heart is completely wasted now because God didn't fight for him all of a sudden. Because one guy hid a little bit of sin that nobody knew about. There was sin in the camp. We are told over and over again that sin is like leaven. Corinthians, here in Corinth, they had horrible sin going on in the church, and yet they were so tolerant. They were so proud of how tolerant they were that they had a guy who was sleeping with his dad's wife in the church, and everybody knew. And they just kept him in there. That's okay. It's okay. We'll just, it's all right. Hey, it's all right for you. You're not doing it here in the church. We're tolerant. We are so tolerant and loving. And Paul said, what is wrong with you people? Why have you not kicked his butt out? I tell you what, you should be grieving that you are so tolerant of the sin. It's going to rip you apart. It doesn't just stay in one place. It spreads and it infects everybody. It's like leaven. It's like yeast in bread. And when it starts over here, if you don't cut it out, it's going to spread. And pretty soon all kinds of stuff. And Paul says, look, I want to save that guy. Don't you understand? If you let that guy continue like that, it's going to be his destruction. And if you let him think everything's okay by putting around an arm around his shoulder and playing church with him, he's going to be wrecked. Kick him out. Let him feel the pain of separation, and maybe he'll repent. And we find out in 2 Corinthians that he does. And he comes back because of the pain of separation. We're told about different leavens we stay away from. Leaven of Pharisees, which is the legalism. Legalism is leaven. Can spread through. Being rule keepers so that you can be right with God. That's leaven. That's like sin. Sadducees, they were the liberals. They were everything's good to go. Certainly that is just as sinful. And then even the sin that we're talking about, the leaven of Herod is mentioned in one place, where Herod was the ruler and it was all politicalism and it was being a respecter of persons and playing the politics games and, being a member of the clergy of the upper class and you are the laity, the lower. That's why I'm up and you're down. That's gross. All of it's gross and all of it's sin and all of it's leaven and it spreads and the Lord says cut it out because it will affect the whole camp and you guys will be defeated. on. I mean, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know what's going on in you guys' life. I know what's going on in my life. I know what the Lord talks to me about and tells me to cut it out when I go places I shouldn't go. Praise God, I don't go there as often as I used to. Usually it's just for a little while in my head before I go, what are you thinking, and go away. But you know, we need to be men and women who are conscious of where the sin is in our own lives and bring it into the light so it can be dealt with. We have that promise in 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sin, he's faithful and just to forgive us of our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Cleanse, katarizo, it's where we get catharized from, like to drain out the poison. And it's a matter of confessing, agreeing with God that it's sin and getting rid of it, because it affects everybody. You know, I don't know what the effect of one person living in sin and openly or quietly rebellious to God is upon our fellowship. I don't know. Who knows? I know that if it comes out and there's somebody who's going here who is playing Joe Christian, and then it comes out and everybody else is going to see that and say, see, they're no different than anybody else. I thought maybe that one was different. I've been to all the other churches and they're a bunch of hypocrites. Finally, I thought I saw one, but nope, because so-and-so is doing the same thing just like everybody else. Them Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. I might as well go to the bar. At least we're all the same there. I don't want to be the guy that causes somebody to do that. I've been that guy before. I don't want to be that guy anymore. And I encourage you, if that's you, if you're dealing with garbage in your life, get rid of it, because it affects everybody. We need to be people like Joshua who are obedient, who are seeking the Lord ahead. Joshua learned that lesson here. And trusting in him, because we all have stuff to face that there's no way we can possibly do it. Make sense? Yeah. Let's leave on a song, Bobby. You guys want to come up and we'll do a song and get out of here. Let me pray while they're getting set up. Lord, thank you so much that you're not content to let us stay as we were. Lord, you want to cleanse us. Lord, you want to make us more and more like you every day. Lord, my prayer is that you would help us to each examine ourselves.